Nehemiah chapter 5, we're going to be looking at that in just a moment, continuing our series of leadership lessons from this book. When the early church was first established, Satan did everything he could to disrupt the growth of it through persecution and intimidation from outside forces. But as one early Christian writer once wrote, the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. And what he meant was by that was that the more that the church was persecuted, the more it grew, vindicating the statement that Jesus made in Matthew 16 and verse 18, that even the gates of hell itself would not prevail against the church. But history also reveals that once Satan fails to succeed with outside intimidation, he then attempts to join the church and attack it from within. And this also occurred in the early centuries as pagan forces infiltrated the church, becoming Christians in name only, but never in heart or in truth. And they introduced practices and heresies that crippled the church for centuries. Because Satan knows that if he can get God's children fighting and quarreling, and he can provide ammunition to both sides, he doesn't have to attack it from the outside. And it's during these tumultuous times, when the faithful start to slip, distracted by strife and division, this is when God's people need leaders to take a stand. As we considered Nehemiah chapter 4 a couple weeks ago in our prior lesson on leadership, we observed how it ended in great victory. Because despite the obstacles of criticism and the discouragement that came from the surrounding nations, Nehemiah and the people in chapter 4, they fought through it. They worked with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other, resolving not to let the enemy prevent them from doing the great work that God had begun in them. But in chapter 5, the devil sets out to create strife amongst God's people by pitting them against one another. And the people needed a leader to help guide them through the problem. And Nehemiah understood that no matter how strong those walls would become, the city would never be safe while there was internal abuse. And so this great leader, having dealt with outside conflict in chapter 4, now in chapter 5 wrestles against the conflict within the walls themselves. What was the problem that the people were having with one another? Read with me beginning in verse 1 of chapter 5. Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters, are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were others who said, "We're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine." Also, there were those who said, "We've borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already. And we're helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others." So this was a money problem. Someone once said, "Mo money, mo problems." And that's true, but in this case, it's mo money, no money, no problems, I should say. No money. They didn't have any. And these problems were creating division among the people, and it was threatening the completion of their God-given work. It was a three-pronged issue. First, we read that there was a famine. And famine always creates a supply and demand ripple effect of making food more expensive. So expensive, in fact, that we are told that the people were mortgaging their property just so they could eat. And a famine is no one's fault per se, but there may be blame in how it is addressed, because apparently the wealthier Jews who could afford the markup were taking advantage of the crisis by charging exorbitant interest rates. If you look down in verse 11, it appears to suggest that the Jews were charging a hundredth part, which we interpret to be 1% per month, which that would amount to 12% a year. That's really high interest. It's what we call usury. And this is something that was specifically forbidden in the law of Moses. If you look in Exodus chapter 22, we'll look at a verse in Exodus 22 and then in Deuteronomy 23. But in Exodus chapter 22, beginning in verse 25, The law of Moses said in Exodus 22, verse 25, that if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. And then if you flip to Deuteronomy chapter 23, Deuteronomy chapter 23, and in verse 19, we read this, Deuteronomy 23, verse 19, you shall not charge interest to your countrymen, interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned at interest. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen you shall not charge interest, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land in which you are about to enter to possess. So it's not just that they were wrong for charging high interest to their countrymen, they were wrong for charging interest at all. And some of the Jews, not being able to handle their payments, were in default. And they were having to sell not only their land, but were having their children taken away from them and slayed by their lenders just to pay off the debt. And this same law prohibited slavery amongst the Jews. You could render service, says to a lender, in payment of a note, but that person could not be your slave. And even if they were to be freed in the year of Jubilee. And on top of it all, King Artaxerxes' high taxation on the provinces, that was just an added burden. And the Jews just couldn't handle it. These issues, they're just an unbearable strain on the people's finances, on their pocketbooks, on their families. It was playing with their emotions, and ultimately it was affecting the work of God. And if Nehemiah, as a leader, didn't do something about this, pretty soon that work was going to permanently halt without one single arrow being fired from the enemy. And so how did this great leader respond to such a crisis? Well, if you look in verse 6, the first thing he did is he got angry. In verse 6, it says, "Then I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words." Nehemiah wasn't angry because the work on the wall was interrupted. Nehemiah was angry because the people had disregarded the law that was designed to separate them from other people as a witness to God. Because they are doing the very kinds of things that led to the destruction of that city just 100 years prior. I mean, wouldn't you be angry? Wouldn't you be frustrated that a people who could stand so strong in chapter 4 against outside forces could fall so quickly into disunity? You know, sometimes we talk about the danger of anger, unbridled, uncontrolled wrath, and we should. But getting angry over sin is absolutely appropriate, as Jesus himself did so because of the hardness of heart of some of the religious elite of his day. Righteous indignation, when it's restrained, when the sun doesn't go down on it, is an appropriate response to sin, especially a response of leaders who, for the sake of those who follow them, cannot afford to walk a path of indifference when blatant sin is occurring. And so that's the first thing he did, is he got angry. But what we also need to notice is that he took this anger toward what was happening and he channeled it appropriately. Look in verse 7. The first thing we read in verse 7 is he said, "I consulted with myself." Now, this is significant because what it means is he didn't go off in a rage with guns blazing at everybody. As every wise leader does, he got angry, but he stopped. He cooled off, and he thought things through rationally, no doubt prayed about these things, as Nehemiah often did, and only then did he actually take action. In Proverbs chapter 16, in verse 32, the Proverb writer tells us, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city." So the fact that he paused to consult with himself in order to act rather than react, that shows great leadership ability. Great leaders rightly and passionately get angry over sin, but they're also wise enough to not act until they've considered the matter very carefully. And that's what Nehemiah did. And that's when he addressed the issue head on. And great leaders do that. Look again in verse 7. He addressed the issue head on. Nehemiah 5, verse 7, it says, "I consulted with myself," and then notice this, "and contended with the nobles and rulers and said to them, 'You are exacting usury, each from his brother.' Therefore I held a great assembly against them. I said to them, we according to our ability have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? Then they were silent and could not find a word to say. Again I said, the thing which you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? You see, Nehemiah got angry and he consulted with himself, but when he was done, he addressed the issue head on. There is a time to be diplomatic and careful before leveling an accusation, and then there is a time to call it for what it is. They were charging their fellow Jews outrageous interest, enslaving them when they couldn't repay the debt, and then reminds them of the consequences of doing these kind of things. He says, you're losing your distinction in the eyes of the surrounding nation. This is very reminiscent of what Nathan told David in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 14, when he told David, you've given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. That's what's on the line every single time one of God's disciples sins. What Nehemiah teaches us here is that a leader approaches a problem head on, regardless of who it is and regardless of how they may respond. Even if the people that are in sin, even if they're the rich and the powerful, as was no doubt the case here, that does not exclude them from rebuke when needed. It doesn't matter how the person reacts. It doesn't matter if they get angry. It doesn't matter if they get defensive. It doesn't matter if they leave us and join another church or if they drop out of the church altogether without dealing with their sin, because sin must be confronted when it is amongst God's people, because that is the Bible way. And all leaders must develop the fortitude and wisdom to do so, because the Lord's cause is on the line. Now, to their credit, these people listened. Because in verse 9, it tells us that they were silent and could not find a word to say. I mean, what could they say? I mean, Nehemiah presented an airtight case. But imagine if he didn't. Imagine if he didn't tackle the problem head on. Imagine what the state of the nation would have been like if he hadn't temporarily stopped the work to fix the conflict within. Most of you are probably aware of the Babylon Bee website, that religious satire website. It released an article a couple weeks ago that got my attention. The title of the article was, Russia Announces Plan to Just Let the U.S. Tear Itself Apart Unaided. I thought, well, there's an air of truth to that, you know? I mean, outside forces don't have to attack us as long as we're killing each other within. And you know, that was a humorous headline, and all satire is intended to be humorous, but it contains an error of truth. See, Satan doesn't have to use outside forces, brethren. As long as he can get us here to tear one another apart, he can wreak havoc. And in almost every case when this is happening, the only way it's going to get corrected is when leaders take a stand. And that's what Nehemiah does next. He doesn't just hurl a few rebukes and then walk away. What Nehemiah does next is he takes corrective action. Look in verse 10. It says, and likewise I, my brothers and my servants, are lending them money and grain. Please leave off this usury. Please give them back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, also the 100th part of their money and of the grain, the new wine, and the oil that you are exacting from them. Then they said, we will give it back, and will require nothing from them. We will do exactly as you say. So I called the priests and took an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. I also shook out the front of my garment and said, thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen. And they praised the Lord, and the people did according to this promise. What I love about this is that not only did Nehemiah determine to stop the sin in its tracks, but he actually gave the people a specific plan on how to do it that would ensure accountability before God as well as before the people. And that's smart. Have you ever been guilty of some sin and you know it and it's just eating you up inside and you're resolved to fix it, but as soon as you do, you just find yourself backsliding within days, if not within hours? You know, leaders who've been around the block a bit, they understand that so many sins have a lesser likelihood of getting permanently resolved, though the spirit longs to do so, when the flesh is so weak. And so perhaps accountability. Perhaps that's the missing step in dealing with an area of difficulty, and perhaps that is why Nehemiah has a great leader employed it here. Brethren, when internal conflict arises amongst God's people and the work that we do is being distracted from, great leaders understand that nothing we can do out there is going to matter if we don't fix what's in here. And so leaders must react to conflict within by being righteously indignant enough to attack the problem head on and then channeling that anger into corrective action by which they can convict the gainsayer who is caught in the devil's snares. And Nehemiah does that so effectively here in the first 13 verses of chapter 5. If we learn something else about leadership in the latter part of the last part of Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 14 and 19, by examining the example of Nehemiah himself and how he personally viewed his leadership role. I want to read verse 14. It says, "Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance." You'll recall back in chapter 2 that before Nehemiah left his post as Artaxerxes' cupbearer to help rebuild the walls, he actually gave the king a specific amount of time he would be gone, and we don't know what that time was, but chapter 6 that we're going to look at in just a bit tells us that he completed the walls in 52 days. But the text that we just read said that he was governor in Jerusalem for 12 years. How he was promoted to this extended role, we're unfortunately not told. However, he does spend the last 6 verses of chapter 5 detailing how he approached this promotion, this exalted role as governor to the people. First, every leadership role, no matter what it is, it contains certain perks, does it not? How did Nehemiah deal with the perks and privileges that came with his governorship? Well, the second part of verse 14 that we just read, he said, "Neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance." That's how he dealt with it. Abraham Lincoln once said that nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. And that is absolutely right. There really are few men who can climb the ladder of success without the dizzying heights upsetting their spiritual equilibrium and leading them to a fall. Very few men can do it. But then there are men who maintain their integrity, who in their promotion refuse to demote God from his rightful position as Lord of their lives. And Nehemiah was one of these men. Every leadership position carries with it certain privileges, certain benefits, certain rights, certain special favors. And few can resist tapping into them, but Nehemiah, he refused to indulge in these privileges. Not while his people were still facing hardship. Nehemiah never expected more from his followers than he expected of himself. You know, the Apostle Paul had the same mentality from the scripture reading we read this morning. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he told the church there that he had rights as an apostle, as a preacher of the gospel, but he never took advantage of those rights. In verse 19 of 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19, he says, "For though I am free from all men, I've made myself a slave to all so that I may win more." And that's exactly the mentality that Nehemiah had. Nehemiah is a great example of a leader who put the work of God ahead of the perks. He put the work of God before his own personal interests. That though he had rights as their leaders, he didn't take advantage of those rights, because it wouldn't help the work he was trying to accomplish among them. And then he goes on to contrast his leadership policy, his personal leadership policy, with prior leadership policies in verse 15. You know, nearly every leadership position carries with it the temptation and the pressures related to policies of the predecessor. I mean, you can either do what's always been done, or you can try to do something new and run the risk of stepping on toes in the process. What did Nehemiah do about this temptation? In verse 15, this is what he did. He said, "But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people
and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. See, to Nehemiah, it didn't matter what others did. It didn't matter how the crowd acted or what the rest of the world thought. He lived by another standard, another policy. Nehemiah did what was right before God, not what was right for his own cares and concerns. Because not only had God put him in this position, he knew he was going to have to answer to God. And when the world with its standards and policies become a snare and a temptation is there to just do what people in the world have always done, may we remember that we live by a higher standard because of our love for Jesus. Nehemiah also didn't let his political position distract him from what he was there to do. And what he was there to do was work. In verse 16, he said, I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We didn't buy any land. And all my servants were gathered there for the work. You know, certainly Nehemiah knew in advance that once those walls got up, real estate prices in Jerusalem were just going to skyrocket. Any man with common sense would have known that. Boy, what a cool thing it would have been to buy up all that land while it was still cheap, get the walls up, and then sell it at a great profit. He could have done that, but he didn't. Because 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4 says, no soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life. And Nehemiah, boy, what a living example of the truth of that verse he was. Nehemiah was there to work. He stayed focused on the work. He never lost sight of the primary task, leading this people in the work that God would have them to do. That's why he was there. And then notice his attitude toward the people in verse 17. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me. And once in 10 days all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand a governor's food allowance because the servitude was heavy on this people. Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. And so not only did Nehemiah not take what he could have, he also gave to others what he didn't have to give. He received a lot of food from the king's provisions, which he could have sold for his own profit. But he gave them away, feeding as many as 150 people regularly to be an example of generosity and compassion. You know, there are a lot of leaders out there who don't think twice about running over others in order to accomplish their own objectives. But without people, tasks crumble. And seeing the heavy servitude on the people, Nehemiah, he adjusted his leadership to lighten their load and to see to their needs and not his own. In his book called Spiritual Leadership, author J. Oswald Sanders said the following relative to this idea. He said, the man who is impatient with weakness will be defective in his leadership. The evidence of our strength lies not in racing ahead, but in a willingness to adapt our stride to the slower pace of our weaker brother while not forfeiting our lead. If we run too far ahead, we lose our power to influence. And that's what leadership is. Leadership is influence. Brethren, nowhere will a man's integrity be more tested than when God raises him up to positions of prominence and authority. But Nehemiah, such a great example, he understood that true leadership is not about demanding your rights. It's not about the perks. It's not about the prior policy. It's all about the people. And then finally, I want to briefly consider what we learn from the first part of Nehemiah chapter 6. If you turn there, Nehemiah chapter 6. We read in verse 1, some more bad news. Verse 1 of Nehemiah 6 says that it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Geshem the Arab, and to the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall, and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors in the gates. You know, for the opposition that had given Nehemiah such a hard time, with all the walls completed and just the gates needing to be done, this was a now or never situation for them. If they didn't do something to stop the work, those walls were going to be completely closed in. And so what they're going to do in chapter 6 is they're going to go after Nehemiah directly this time. And creatively at that, perhaps knowing that leaders are often more susceptible when they're intoxicated with success. But like that wily coyote, no matter how much they plotted and schemed, Nehemiah was like Roadrunner. I mean, he was just able to sniff it out. Every Acme device that they threw at him, he was able to just tell exactly what was going on. Because as a great leader, he had that sixth sense called discernment. The enemies attempted three different plots, and I want you to notice how Nehemiah countered them. Verse 2, Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, come, let us meet together at Shephram in the plain of Ono. But they were planning to harm me. And verse 4 says that they tried this four times. And you know, perhaps to many, this offer would seem like a much welcome relief from all that rugged work that was being undertaken. And some might interpret this as an invitation for a peace offering. But again, Nehemiah had the discernment of that roadrunner. He smelled a trap. And he also saw danger in separating himself from the work when it was so close to being completed. And so he responds this way in verse 3. It says, so I sent messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work, and I can't come down. Why would the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? You know, sometimes a leader has to say, I'm not doing this. There's other things I need to be focused on. And I think that's another sign of mature leadership. Learning to say no. To not be a puppet to man. That being a leader does not automatically mean that I have an obligation to please everybody. Nehemiah had that. Nehemiah had discernment toward his enemies, and he had discernment toward the more important work that was going on in Jerusalem. Every leader doing God's work will have to contend with 100 different plots and 100 different causes, but leaders must stay focused to truly be effective. So he didn't take the bait, but when he didn't, Sanballat tries something else. Now Sanballat resorts to political propaganda in the form of an open letter. Verse 5 says, then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a fifth time with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, it's reported among the nations, and Geshem says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore you are rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king. According to these reports, you've also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king according to these reports. So come now, let us take counsel together. You know, this slander, it begins the same way pretty much all verbal attacks do. Have you heard what the people are saying? Everybody's talking about this. That's what it is. I mean, can you imagine a letter like this worming its way through everybody before it finally gets to Nehemiah? I mean, Nehemiah may have even known what the contents of the letter were before it even arrived, because gossip is one of the speediest courier services that there is. And you know, a surface reading of the accusations, it might lead one to think, oh man, they've got him now. I mean, that's the last thing Nehemiah needs, that false info getting back to Artaxerxes. Because if he refused to meet them again, that would look like the same thing as admitting guilt. But if he did meet them, he'd be walking into a trap. But I want you to notice again Nehemiah's discernment in verse 8 and how he handled this. It says, then I sent a message to him saying, such things as you are saying have not been done, but you are inventing them in your own mind. For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. And brethren, when a false charge gets us all in a tizzy, I want you to know that that's exactly how you handle it. You calmly deny it, you place the blame where it belongs, and you take those anxieties that those accusations create, you take them to God's throne. That's all you need in such situations. You don't need to mount an elaborate defense towards that person, because someone like Sanballat, you know, to try to attempt to prove him wrong point by point, you don't satisfy men like Sanballat with facts and evidence. You satisfy men like Sanballat by giving in to their demands. And Nehemiah refused to do that. because he had the discernment to know that this slander strategy was simply about inducing fear and nothing more. But see, brethren, the enemy can't make us afraid. The enemy out there, he cannot cause us to be afraid. We choose whether or not we want to be afraid. We choose whether we want to be paralyzed by fear over what others could be saying about us. That's our choice. That's not something that they force us into. But the enemy can't make us afraid. And people are going to talk about it anyway, so there's little you can do about it. All we need to do is live our lives in such a way that if someone does speak badly about us, no one would even believe it. One commentator named Redpath said it like this: no man can lead a work of God if he allows himself to be governed by what other people think. He is to secure help, fellowship, prayer, advice, and he's foolish not to take it. But if his ultimate decisions are based on popular opinion, he is going to fall. And that's absolutely right. Nehemiah had the discernment to know he had enough work to do as it was without trying to curb bad press. He knew that was an exercise of futility. And so when slander didn't work, now they try to catch Nehemiah off guard. That's the third thing they do. Verse 10, they try to catch him off guard. In verse 10 it says, when I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaiah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined at home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night. But I said, should a man like me flee? And could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. This was an ingenious move by the enemy. Catch Nehemiah with his guard down in a place that he would feel most secure, the temple. But see, only priests were allowed in the temple. And Nehemiah was not a priest. And if he had listened to this, if he had given into his fear and done this, he would have been disobeying God had he done this and listened to Shemaiah. And so Nehemiah, because like that roadrunner, he was such a discerning leader, he sniffed it out. In verse 12, it says, then I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me, because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. The idea was, if they could get Nehemiah afraid and cause him to make a mistake of going into that temple, they would have grounds to accuse him and to discredit him. But Nehemiah's discernment not only sniffed out the trap, it exposed Shemaiah as nothing more than a false prophet on Sanballat's payroll. They're seeking to persuade Nehemiah into an easygoing, compromising religion that will shirk persecution and carry no cross, governed by the fears and opinions of other people. But instead of lashing out against his enemies, as is the pattern throughout his entire life, he once again takes his anxieties to God in verse 14, saying, remember, oh my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these works of theirs, and also Noadiah, the prophetess, and the rest of the prophets who were trying to frighten me. Brethren, what we learn from chapter 6 is this: every leader, to be an effective one, must develop this sixth sense of discernment, to see things as God sees them. You know, discernment is not being negative, it's not being cynical. Because the discerning man is just as able to see the good where others might miss it as he'll see the bad where others might mistakenly see good according to outward appearance. And so many Christians suffer a great deal because they lack this discernment. They follow leaders and teachers who give a good appearance, but they don't walk in the footsteps of Jesus. They accept things blindly because it looks good, because it sounds good, without carefully judging it against the whole counsel of God. And so any man who wishes to spiritually lead others, they have to have this discernment like Nehemiah in order to protect not only himself, but also protect those under his leadership. And you know what? Because Nehemiah had this discernment, notice the result in verse 15. Verse 15 tells us that the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. When our enemies heard of it, and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Because Nehemiah had discernment, because he stayed on his knees in prayer, because he was determined not to let anything distract him from the work or put unhealthy fear in him to make wrong decisions, that's how he was able to navigate this gigantic project to completion in 52 days. That's so remarkable. Brethren, if God could get Nehemiah this far, certainly he was able to take him further and take care of his enemies according to his divine wisdom. I mean, those walls, they had been in ruin for more than 100 years, and they were set right again in less than 2 months' time. And if God can work through a man like Nehemiah, the same God we serve, who sits on his throne in heaven, he can work that same way through you and I. Let us resolve in whatever leadership position that we find ourselves in here this morning, whatever leadership position that we may desire to be in at some point in our life, let us resolve to always attend to our followers' needs, to be humble enough to know how to appropriately handle our position, and that we learn the ability to discern those things that are not easily seen. If you are here this morning and you're not a Christian, if you've not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, we would certainly encourage you to consider doing so this morning. If you believe that he is the Son of God and you're willing to repent of your sins and confess that he is Lord, we can baptize you this morning. Those sins can be washed away. And likewise, if you're a believer, if you're a Christian this morning and you've been plagued by some sin, some public sin, and you need help or you need prayers or need to make a confession, we'd likewise encourage you to come forward and make that known so that we can help you while we stand, while we sing the invitation song.